This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Great to have you listening in to Trumpet Hour today. I'm Joel Hilliker. This past Saturday, the most elaborate scientific instrument on Earth blasted off of Earth's surface to begin a journey of 1,000,000 miles. This is the James Webb Space Telescope. It's a $10 billion, 25-year project. 27 minutes after liftoff, the launch vehicle rocket released this folded-up telescope and sent it on its own toward a special point in space, and it will deploy along its journey its solar panel antenna, 5 hairbreadth polyimide membranes for a tennis court-sized sun shield, secondary mirror, an enormous 21-foot beryllium primary mirror. Now, a lot of things could go wrong and render this whole project fruitless. But if they all go right, this telescope will begin sending scientific images back to Earth in late March. It will become fully operational in June, and it will show us infrared light that originated billions of light years away, exoplanets and other images and data revealing more about the universe and its history than we've ever known. This is what NASA Administrator Bill Nelson said after the launch of the James Webb Telescope.
And now we have to realize there are still innumerable things that have to work, and they have to work perfectly, 344 of them. But we know that in great reward, there is great risk. And that's what this business is all about. And that's why we dare to explore. The James Webb Space Telescope is very much a part of that exploration.
In this speech, he specifically mentioned this project being a part of a long tradition of human beings peering into the heavens and searching for answers, a tradition that goes back to the times of the Bible. He said this.
But it's another millennia before that a shepherd grazing his sheep would look up at the night sky. He became a poet, and he penned the words, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork." That shepherd, that poet, became king. And those immortal words in Psalm 19 encapsulate the expressions that we have today, the handiwork of God as we peer back in time over 13 billion years ago, capture the light from the very beginning of the creation.
The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. That is actually a passage in Scripture that has inspired astronomers and other scientists for centuries. We'll look at it more in depth later in the program, but there's a common belief today that science and religion are at odds with one another. If you're religious, you're anti-science. That is totally false. Actually, the study of modern science was largely built and created by men who were very religious. Many of them looked at the Bible and the creation as two compatible ways that God speaks to mankind. Isaac Newton was one of the greatest mathematicians, physicists, and most influential scientists of all time. And he studied his Bible. He actually wrote more about theology than about physics. And he was really struck by scriptures like Romans 1 and verse 20, which says, "The invisible things of him, God, from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. That's saying we learn a lot about God through his creation. And that's an amazing statement. It says the invisible things of God are clearly seen. We can see the invisible by looking at the things that God made. We can even understand his eternal power and Godhead. When we look at his creation, we are looking right at it. Just look at the artistry, the beauty, the variety. Look at the phenomenal engineering, down to subatomic detail. Look at the size, the scope, the majesty, which is far beyond our comprehension. And you can learn a lot about God. You learn a lot about the scale of his plans and his ambitions. Now, God supplies revelation in the Bible for what can't be discerned materially. But he also expects us to reason, to gain knowledge, to be educated. He wants us to look into these things, study into these things, to come to know him even better. In the book How the West Won by Rodney Stark, there's a fascinating chapter that talks about how the biblical beliefs of men like Isaac Newton gave birth to modern science. Most people through history have believed that the world is inherently irrational. You study ancient pagan civilizations, and these people looked at the sun and the moon and the stars and phenomena like eclipses, and they believed that all those lights, all those bodies out there were gods, and that they had independent will, that they went wherever they wanted, that the movement of the planets demonstrated independent will on the part of these godlike beings. Now, the God of the Bible is very different. He's all-powerful. He is the creator. He is a loving God. He's deeply involved in his creation. And he's also rational. He always has good reasons for doing what he does. He's a God of reason, of order, and of law. James 4 and verse 12 calls him the lawgiver. It says there is one lawgiver, and that's not just talking about spiritual laws or moral laws. It's also talking about the laws of physics, the laws of conservation, the laws of mechanics, the laws of gravitation and relativity and thermodynamics and so on. Rodney Stark says, science arose only because the doctrine of the rational creator of a rational universe made scientific inquiry plausible. Mathematician John Lennox said this, at the heart of all science lies the conviction that the universe is orderly. You know, if you don't believe that the universe is governed by law, then why study into it? This is what Melanie Phillips wrote in her book, The World Turned Upside Down. This absolutely fundamental insight came not from the Greeks, but thousands of years previously in the Hebrew Bible, with its proposition that the universe was governed by a single God rather than the whims of many gods. Western science grew from the novel idea that the universe was rational, and that belief was given to us by Genesis, which set out the revolutionary proposition that the universe had a rational creator. C.S. Lewis said this, men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. Now, it's easy for us to take this for granted, but that is not the way most people throughout history have looked at the world. And even today, like say if you look at Islam, for example, Muslims do not believe that God runs the universe according to laws. They say that Allah can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. And that means that the universe is inherently irrational. There is no cause and effect because everything happens because of Allah's will at that moment. Rodney Stark wrote how many Muslim scholars have held that efforts to formulate natural laws are blasphemy because they would seem to deny Allah's freedom to act. Thus did the Chinese, Greek, and Muslim images of God in the universe deflect scientific efforts. So those efforts to study into what was happening in the world, it was erroneous ideas about God that prevented that, or that suppressed even the desire to look into those things. But it was men who were looking into the Bible and that came to know things about the God of the Bible who actually sought to pursue scientific pursuits. Science and religion are not fundamentally at odds with each other. The truth is that there would be no science without religion. Now, NASA's Bill Nelson quoted Psalm 19, written by King David. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament, or the expanse of the heavens, shows his handiwork. It's all out there for everybody to see. In that vast universe, God reveals himself. That creation reveals God. And today, thanks to modern telescopes, we see far more of that glory and that handiwork than King David did when he wrote those words. In that psalm, Psalm 19, verse 2 says, "Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night shows knowledge." That word utters means pours forth or prophesies. The universe is prophesying. It's constantly pouring forth prophecy. Now, what is it saying? What is the universe saying? What is its prophecy? This psalm continues in verse 3 in the Revised Standard Version. "There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, yet their voice goes out through all the earth." God has a message in everything that he put out there. And what is that message? If you read verse 4 in the King James Version, it says, "Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." Their line means their rule or direction. It's talking about the fact that everything follows God's rule, God's direction. The universe declares God's glory because God rules it. The heavens declare God's glory because they get their direction from God, from the lawgiver. Now, that word line can also mean a chord, especially for measuring, or a rule. It can also mean a musical string or a chord or harmony. The Apostle Paul actually quotes this verse in his epistle to the Romans, Romans 10 and verse 18, and he uses the word sound. Their sound went into all of the earth. He's talking about the harmony in the heavens. He's likening it to a musical sound, and he's saying this is the way it should be on earth. This is the way it should be in our lives. This is the way it's going to be very soon all over the earth. But if you have God's rule or direction, then you have a chord. You have harmony. Everything works together, just like an orchestra playing in harmony. Anywhere you find true harmony, anywhere on earth, that's no accident. And if you find disharmony, you find breaking God's law. You find people who are not subject to God. The universe declares the glory of God because it perfectly obeys the laws of God. God is conducting the orchestra. And this is a marvelous lesson we can take from those physical bodies out in the universe. To declare God's glory, we need to let God rule and direct us. The law of God is the way to establish glory in your life. Now, at the end of verse 4, this psalm continues, "In them has he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices as a strong man to run a race." Just think about our sun. It's like a strong man, like a powerful athlete. A 1 megaton nuclear bomb has the explosive power of 1 million tons of TNT, and the sun produces the same amount of energy as a trillion of those bombs every second. In 1 second, the sun produces more energy than the entire human species has consumed throughout its entire history. But as it says in verse 6, "His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof." The fact is that God positioned that powerful body, that massive glowing orb of nuclear fusion relative to our planet. He positioned it perfectly so that we could enjoy nice sunny days outside. We can see, we can be warm, the plants can absorb its energy. This is really our main source of energy on planet Earth. Nothing is hid from its heat. The sun dominates our whole solar system. It accounts for 99.9% of all the visible matter in our solar system. You could fit a million planet Earths inside of it. And really, this is a picture of how God should dominate our lives. Our lives should revolve around God the way that our planet revolves around the sun. You notice how David develops this theme. What produces all that harmony in the universe? Verse 7 says, "The law of the eternal is perfect, converting the soul." There is a connection between those astral bodies and the law of God. Everything God is involved in, he does according to law. And we can thank God for that. Gravity prevents you from drifting off into space each day. The sun is going to have 24 hours in it because of the rotation of the Earth. The sun will keep burning at a trillion megaton nuclear bombs per second. The speed of light never changes. These are physical laws established by the great lawgiver. And God uses those laws to govern the entire material universe. And that makes it orderly and reliable. Dinesh D'Souza said, "The great scientists have been struck by how strange this is. There is no logical necessity for a universe that obeys rules, let alone one that abides by the rules of mathematics. This astonishment springs from the recognition that the universe doesn't have to behave this way. It's easy to imagine a universe in which conditions change unpredictably from instant to instant, or even a universe in which things pop in and out of existence." Richard Feynman, a Nobel Prize winner for quantum electrodynamics, said this, "The fact that there are rules at all is a kind of miracle." But this is the way the whole universe operates. Just think about what's happening out there. Understand just how perfectly submitted to God's law and rule all of that is. That's why the heavens declare God's glory. That's how your life can declare God's glory. This thought continues in Psalm 19, verse 8. "The statutes of the eternal are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the eternal is pure, enlightening the eyes." God's law makes us rejoice. This is really a prophecy about what that law will do in your life. There are commentaries that look into this psalm and say there's a switch in the subject here, but there really isn't. The reason the heavens prophesy is because of the law. And if we apply God's law in our lives, in our marriage, in our family, it will rejoice our heart. When we break it, we get negative and discouraged and miserable. This is prophecy. This is what is going to happen all over the earth soon. People are going to be taught how to keep the law, and they will be rejoicing. And this is something we really should be doing in our lives today. We should be building that harmony with God, harmony with fellow human beings, harmony in our marriages and families. Is your life making beautiful music for God? Is your life declaring God's glory? Is your life a prophecy of what this whole world is going to be like shortly? We need to get in sync with the creator and the conductor of the harmony of the universe, just like the sun does, as it spreads its wonderful light and warmth all over the earth in perfect harmony with the laws of God. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're talking about the James Webb Space Telescope and how it's being sent out to study the heavens, which declare the glory of God. When we come back, we'll talk about two schools of thought within the scientific community. One is those scientists who totally deny God, and they insist the material world can be entirely explained without God. And the other, which was expressed by NASA Administrator Bill Nelson, those scientists who are studying the universe and the material world, and they're increasingly coming to recognize that God must be behind it. Stick around.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
For many centuries, people that we would consider modern scientists believed in God. But in the 19th century, they began to look for entirely materialistic explanations of everything. And they just assumed matter and energy were eternal and self-existent. It just always existed. So they didn't feel the need to explain where it all came from. In his book, Return of the God Hypothesis, scientist Stephen Meyer talks about how the more that scientists learn about the universe, the more it is destroying their theories for how it all came about by itself. The more we learn, the more our instruments enable us to peer into deep space, the clearer it is there had to be a creation event. There had to have been an event that gave birth to the universe. And Stephen Meyer goes into all the scientific explanations, but he just explains one theory after another, how it was proven wrong. He talks about a conference of top astronomers in 1985, and he writes, one was widely respected as one of the great observational astronomers of the 20th century. He was also well known as an agnostic with a materialistic philosophy of science. During his talk, however, he not only described the astronomical evidence for the beginning of the universe, he shocked many of his colleagues by announcing a recent religious conversion and then explaining how the scientific evidence of a creation event had contributed to a profound change in his worldview. I recall his looking intently at the audience and gravely stating, "Here is evidence for what can only be described as a supernatural event. What has happened in the last 50 years is a remarkable event within astronomy and astrophysics. I think all scientists at the deepest level are so startled by what they see in the miraculousness of the interconnection of things in their field that they at least have wondered why it is this way." It's quite a remarkable admission. We read in Romans 1 and verse 20 that if we study the visible things, if we study God's handiwork, then we're going to learn things about the invisible things. We'll gain appreciation for his eternal power, even learn about his divinity. We're going to see there had to be a great God behind this. There's absolutely no other way that all of this could have come together. And of course, with advanced telescopes and other modern extraordinary instruments of science, it's all the more obvious. And that verse, Romans 1 and verse 20, ends by saying, because of this, they are without excuse. You know, despite all of the evidence, there are still many scientists who refuse to recognize God. The more they learn, the more impressive it is, and the more blind and hard-headed and arrogant they're showing themselves to be. Now, that passage in Romans says this in verse 18, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold or suppress the truth in unrighteousness." Now, Stephen Meyer gives many specific examples of these atheistic scientists who just will not accept the truth that is staring them in the face. They'll devise one theory after another so they don't have to acknowledge God. And there are some really outlandish theories. Richard Dawkins is an evolutionary biologist. He's probably one of the most famous atheist critics of creationists. He loves criticizing creationists. Now, here is an excerpt from Ben Stein's documentary, Expelled. This was made in 2008. And Ben Stein asks Richard Dawkins about the origin of the universe.
Well, then who did create the heavens and the earth?
Why do you use the word who? You see, you immediately beg the question by using the word who.
Well, then how did it get created?
Well, by a very slow process.
Well, how did it start?
Nobody knows how it started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
And what was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right. How did that happen?
I told you we don't know.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, nor has anybody.
Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that there, that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
It could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility and an intriguing possibility. Mm. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Dawkins admitted, we don't know how life started. And he said things like DNA might represent a signature of some kind of designer, but it couldn't be God. He said it's an intriguing possibility that an alien civilization evolved somewhere else in the universe and then designed and seeded the first life on Earth. Does that make sense? In Rodney Stark's book, he says several of the most prominent atheistic skeptics are confident that godlike beings have evolved on distant planets. So that's plausible to these people, but they say you are foolish if you believe in a creator God. Verse 19 in Romans 1 says, that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. God showed it to them. It's manifest. It's plain. It's obvious. And it's inspiring. Melanie Phillips wrote this in The World Turned Upside Down. Scientific discoveries are themselves leading some scientists to believe in a supernatural dimension. Sir Roger Penrose, professor of mathematics at Oxford, says that the balance of nature's laws is so perfect and so unlikely to have occurred by chance that an intelligent creator must have chosen them. The philosopher Anthony Flew progressed from being Britain's most renowned atheist to religious believer through, quote, a pilgrimage of reason. What he found particularly compelling was evidence of the fine-tuning of the universe. From this, he concluded that the laws governing the universe had been crafted to move it toward the sustenance of life, and that all the arguments seeking to explain this away were hopelessly flawed. In his book, Stephen Meyer goes through the math on the fine-tuning of the universe. And he says one mathematician, one scientist, actually described it as the probability of it being tuned to the degree that it is 1 in 10 to the 10th power to the 123rd power. Now, that number has more zeros than there are elementary particles in the entire universe. And, of course, each zero multiplies that number by 10 times. And Stephen Meyer says, a degree of fine-tuning that really is not adequately reflected by the word exquisite. I'm not aware of a word in English that does justice to the kind of precision we are discussing. So what he's saying is that it had to be measured out in just exactly this way for us to be able to even have any kind of life. If things had been off in any of a number of areas, then life would not be able to exist in our universe. One physicist said the really amazing thing is not that life on Earth is balanced on a knife edge, but that the entire universe is balanced on a knife edge and would be total chaos if any one of the natural constants were off even slightly. It'd be total chaos if it were even slightly different. A London Times science journalist said he believes that theistic design is certain. He said, to insist otherwise is like insisting that Shakespeare was not written by Shakespeare because it might have been written by a billion monkeys sitting at a billion keyboards typing for a billion years. the sight of scientific atheists clutching at such desperate straws has put new spring in the step of theists. This is an analogy that Stephen Meyer uses. You think about a room, say an office, and all of the elements in that room. You know, you've got furniture, you have all kinds of papers, and you have pencils and other objects, and you've got books and everything that would be in that office. If you take all of the material in that office, there would be an infinite number of ways where you could cram all of that material in the office in a way that would be disorderly. There would be very few ways that all of those things could be arranged in that room to make for an orderly space. And that never happens by chance. You know, I can say from personal experience, it takes work to keep an office looking tidy and orderly. The same is true of books. That journalist was talking about the billion monkeys sitting at a billion keyboards typing for a billion years. If you just think of a book and all of the letters and all of the individual components that make up that book, there are a lot of combinations of letters. But a book has meaning because there was an author who took concepts, who thought of concepts, and then he expressed them using particular words, and he arranged all of those letters so that they would create sentences and paragraphs that add up to meaning. There are so many combinations that yield chaos. There are very few that yield order. And just picking up a book, you know that that book had an author. And you get to know that author when you read his writing. Imagine someone visiting the studio of a luthier, a violin maker, and touring around and seeing all of the different components and seeing these different violins that are in various stages of manufacture and seeing the horsehair and different types of woods and stains and all of that. And then looking at these violins that were hanging in the shop window and saying, now, how did all of these exquisite violins get here? It's just ludicrous. God says he's angry at these people who deny the truth that they can plainly see. How much truth are these people suppressing because it just doesn't fit their false anti-God ideas? Just to continue this passage in Romans 1, verses 21 and 22 say, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. David, who wrote Psalm 19, he wrote in Psalm 14 that only a fool has said in his heart, there's no God. Only fools say that. And we probably see this more clearly than ever in history, the foolishness of the people who are considered wise in this world. They're showing a lot of foolishness. I'll just give you one quote from a Nobel laureate and physicist, Steven Weinberg. He said this: the world needs to wake up to the long nightmare of religious belief. Anything we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done, and may in fact be our greatest contribution to civilization. Now, there is a lot of false religion out there, and it's not that religion hasn't done damage. False religion does a lot of damage. But to think that belief in God, the God of the Bible, the Creator God, the God who laid all of this out for us and gave us this wonderful, beautiful earth to live on and all of these resources to draw from, that gave us evidence of his design all around us, to believe in him, the greatest contribution science could make would be to destroy that belief. That is dangerous vanity and arrogance and ignorance. Now, this passage in Romans 1 and verse 25, it says, they changed the truth of God into a lie and worshiped and served the creature or the creation more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. That's what so many of these people are doing. They're worshiping the creation. They're worshiping the things God made rather than worshiping the great God. It's terribly shallow. It's a ridiculous lack of perspective. They're looking right at the things that are made. And if they would just open their eyes, they would see the invisible, even his eternal power and Godhead. But instead, they ignore God and they worship the creation. They're looking right at the very handiwork of God and they don't see God. Just ask one of these brilliant scientists who just had a great meal if he believes there's a cook. One astrophysicist wrote a book about what science had proven about the origins of the universe, saying that it is an exceedingly strange development, unexpected by all but the theologians. They have always accepted the word of the Bible. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. This is what many scientists are realizing. They're acknowledging reality. Arno Penzias, a physicist and Nobel laureate, said, "The best data we have concerning the origins of the universe are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, the Bible as a whole." John Polkinghorne said, "We are living in an age where there is a great revival of natural theology taking place. That revival is taking place not on the whole among theologians who have lost their nerve in that area, but among scientists." Isn't that interesting? It's the scientists who are studying into these fantastic vistas of understanding that is being unveiled by a study of the creation that are coming to see God. And the theologians have lost their nerve in that area. Paul talked about just religionists who deny the power of God. It's shameful. And we should not be among them. We should be able to recognize God. We should see God. We should be able to worship God with all our hearts. And as we see science actually confirming the existence of God, this should cause us to rejoice. It should strengthen our faith. It should make us that much more thankful to know God. What are the heavens prophesying? God wants us to know. You can look at the book of Job, the oldest biblical book, or the first book that was written in the Bible, and it shows that Job knew a lot about astronomy. There are several points that indicate deep understanding that science didn't learn until much later. And Job even uses some of God's names for the stars: Arcturus, Orion, Pleiades. He talks about how Earth hangs upon nothing. It's just floating in space. He talks about how God spreads out the heavens. And the language indicates that he knew that we live in an expanding universe. Scientists are just learning about this, but Job knew it. The Bible shows that David knew it, Isaiah knew it, Jeremiah knew it, Zechariah knew it. They all used that same language. And then in the book of Job, you have chapters where God is speaking to Job and revealing fascinating details. How God laid the foundations of the earth and placed it perfectly to host life and measured and surveyed it precisely. He made it the perfect size and gave it the mixture of all the right elements. And he established the physical forces that anchor our planet and stabilize it. There are terms used in those chapters in the Bible that science is only recently beginning to understand. There are things in the Bible that science didn't discover independently until the last 30 years. But God revealed those things to his servants millennia ago. Now, why is that? Well, God wants man to know him. He wants to build a relationship with man. That was before God inspired the Bible. Those men had direct revelation from God. The book Witness of the Stars by Ethelbert Bullinger explains how God revealed a lot about astronomy to the patriarchs like Seth and Abraham. Abraham taught the Babylonians of his day about the sun and the moon and the eclipses, and how all of these things, all of these astral bodies, followed laws laid down by God. Those pagans believed that all those lights out there were gods going wherever they wanted to go. And Abraham showed them, no, they were all created by one God and they follow his laws. He could predict eclipses because those were the results of those bodies obeying physical laws. God taught those great men what the heavens were prophesying. He did that to reveal himself to them, to connect with them, to bring them into his world, bring them into the world of his mind, his thinking, his ambitions. Now we're living in a dangerous time, the end time. The world is really falling apart around us. And God is giving us a more spectacular vision of what all is out there than ever before. We'll take a short break. We'll come back with a last word about why it's so important for us to contemplate the heavens.
It's time for today's last word.
Back in 1990, the Hubble telescope launched. This is a phenomenal achievement in human engineering. It's 43 foot long, weighs 11 tons. It's been orbiting Earth now 335 miles up into space for 31 years, 7 months. This moves at 186,000 miles an hour. It makes a complete trip around the Earth every 95 minutes. So it's made something like 173,000 trips around the Earth. It's traveled 4.3 billion miles. That's the equivalent of 23 round trips to the sun and back, 93 million miles away. Now, this telescope has a huge mirror, 8 feet in diameter. That's the most important part of a telescope, the light collecting mirror. So the bigger the mirror, the more light it collects, the more impressive the images. The size of this mirror allows it to collect 40,000 times more light than the human eye. Hubble has 5 main instruments that observe light in the ultraviolet, visible, and near infrared regions of the electromagnetic spectrum. And it's produced the most spectacular images of the universe we've ever had. That includes Hubble Deep Field. That's when they pointed that telescope at an empty black speck of sky the size of a dime, about 75 feet away, focused it there for 10 days. That image showed that what looked like just a black pinprick of empty space, 1/2 millionth of the sky, actually had about 3,000 galaxies. And each of them averages, you know, something like 200 billion stars. So they pointed it somewhere else to see if that was just a fluke, but everywhere they look, in every little pinprick of space, 3,000 galaxies. So they focused it on an even smaller section of space, 1/12 millionth of the sky, focused it there for 114 days, and they came up with the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, a pinprick of sky. It had 10,000 galaxies in it. So that completely obliterated our understanding of what all is out there. We had to adjust our estimates up to something like 120 billion galaxies in the universe. And if a medium-sized galaxy has 200 billion stars, that's 24 sextillion visible stars. That's a 24 with 21 zeros after it. And of course, each galaxy is estimated to have something like 100 million planets. So this telescope revolutionized our understanding of the universe. And our editor-in-chief said he believed God blessed that project. He was behind it because he wanted to increase our hope and our vision during these very dangerous times. That telescope launched right about the same time as this organization started. The Trumpet magazine started February 1990, just at the beginning of the Philadelphia Church of God, same time as the Hubble launched. the heavens are prophesying. Most people do not know what the heavens are saying. They don't know why God created all that real estate out there. But the Bible reveals it. And we're getting a clearer picture all the time of God's plans for all of that that we've never had before. And at this organization, we feel a certain responsibility to explain the significance of what we're learning out there, what's going on out in the universe. You know, as King David was contemplating the universe, as he wrote Psalm 19 and talking about how the heavens declared the glory of God, he didn't have anything even close to what we have to understand the scope, the magnitude of what's happening in the universe. This really should help us to see the scale of the ambition of God. And really, it should help us to understand God, to think like God. And he's trying to help us to do that. He's trying to get us to set our affection on the thing that his affection is set on. We have a booklet called Our Awesome Universe Potential. We would love to send you a copy of this, or you can go to thetrumpet.com. You can go to the literature tab and you can find it under there. But it explains all of this. That booklet says, here's an inspiring truth. Those Hubble pictures should give this whole world a great deal more hope. It's not only because those countless awesome galaxies point us to their creator and his limitless power. It's also because when understood according to the revelation in the Bible, they expand our understanding of the incredible human potential God has given us. And there's a whole lot of scriptural proof for what that is talking about there. And it really is such a hope-filled vision. Right now, the world is truly falling apart, and people are more hopeless than ever. And it's now that we've just launched this phenomenal new telescope that's going to reveal even greater wonders than we've ever seen before. You had more than 1,000 people from 17 countries pouring tens of millions of hours into this telescope. They studied and used the laws of physics and these other scientific laws we've been talking about. They depend on those laws. They know the better they follow those laws in specific, exacting, minute detail, the more successful their efforts will be. So we've spent a generation learning and applying the laws of the universe to build this James Webb Space Telescope for the sole purpose of learning more about the laws and the facts of the universe. That's amazing. We take it for granted that the universe operates in a grand celestial clockwork of inexorable perfect laws. That's why we build things like space telescopes. And that's how we build them. You know, even these modern scientists who deny God's existence, they base all their thinking on the history of the universe, the present, the future of the universe. They base it all on the fact that it all operates by perfect, finely tuned laws. They built this telescope to function exactly according to these laws. They build all their discoveries on the discoveries of scientists who knew that the scientific laws came from the one lawgiver. Their whole world revolves around these laws given to us by this lawgiver. These are the laws that these James Webb scientists are using to try to put this remarkable instrument out into space to study the universe. Isaiah 40 and verse 26 says, "Lift up your eyes on high and behold who has created these things, that brings out their host by number. He calls them all by names, by the greatness of his might." You know, the universe is awesome. But God says, when you look at it, what he really wants you to see is who created it, who is behind it. This great God, he not only created all these stars, he has names for all of them. And some of those names are in the Bible. God doesn't just call them things like N384Q. He gives them really cool names like Arcturus. And he wants us to behold him. In the former prophet's book that Gerald Fleury wrote, our editor-in-chief, he spent some time talking about 1 Kings 8 and verse 27. That's this place where it says that the heavens and the heavens of heavens cannot contain God. And he says this gives you a sense of the scope of God's ambitions. There's a section in there called Childlike Wonder. And it says, God wants to fill us with wonder at what he is accomplishing. There isn't a lot of childlike wonder in Satan's world. Most people are going in the opposite direction from that. But how can you think about what Solomon was saying in this passage in 1 Kings 8 in conjunction with other verses like Isaiah 9 and verse 7 and Ephesians 3 and verse 9 and not be filled with wonder? This isn't about plucking on harps for eternity. This is the most exciting thing that could come out of the very mind of God. He will fill you with wonder. And we need that. We need to be inspired. We need to use our imaginations to project out into the universe because, after all, we are going to be ruling over it. We need to explain to people how thrilling this all is. That's what this is about. The heavens declare God's glory, and they're going to be declaring God's glory forever. Let me play a couple of excerpts from a message that Mr. Fleury gave about Psalm 19, the heavens declare God's glory. He gave this back in 1996. This is some 25 years ago. This is what he said.
When you see what is happening and has happened in the universe, and how it does declare God's glory, it shows you the purpose of man. You have no other purpose than to declare God's glory. That's why we're here, to declare God's glory. And most of God's people today are not doing that. It isn't because we're greater than they are, or we have more ability. We probably have considerably less. The only reason we declare God's glory is because of God's rule and direction. That's the only reason. You don't declare God's glory any other way.
God says that if we do this right, we will shine like the stars forever and ever. We'll be declaring God's glory forever, just like those physical stars do today. Our purpose in life is to declare God's glory, and the only way that we can do that is to submit to his rule. That's such a powerful lesson that the heavens are teaching us. The heavens are prophesying. Listen to what they're saying. They're teaching us about the past. They're speaking about what is happening and what should be happening right now. And they are prophesying about the majestic future. Mr. Fleury said this.
Verse 2, day after day utters prophecy. It prophesies of that same glory, that same harmony that is going to come to all the universe. If you know God and you know that he's a God of law, you know he's never going to stop until everything is in harmony. We know then it's just a matter of time until God corrects the problem. And he tells us soon, the heavens and the earth are going to declare God's glory.
This is what the heavens are prophesying. Hear what they're saying. Be inspired by that prophecy and get your life in line with the conductor of that universal symphony. Make your life declare God's glory and show his handiwork today. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. You can't depend on your eyes when your imagination is out of focus. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.